Thanks, John. Just getting Mike up here. When you were walking, we were showing you some slides of the temple at Burning Man this year. If many of you were there, I'm going to try to fit that into the talk, because I think it's an important sort of illustrative thing. What we're going to do is that the subject of this talk is really very close to the work that Galen and I do, and that the company, we have 16 people in our company, and we're kind of a ragtag group, work around the world, and we do a lot of projects, and the projects are all out of the edge of cognition. We seem to be getting hired all the time to do work at the boundaries of the ability of the human mind to function, and extending those boundaries. And for example, one of the boundaries is what type of human mind? One of the scary properties of modern life is something known as kind of cognitive overload. And you probably, all of you probably experienced it. This is one too many emails, one too many calls from your teenage kid that's in trouble again, and one too many harassing comments by boss or something, and your brain gets to this sort of mush phase. And this is a property that's pretty rare in primate development and primate history to reach that phase. In fact, if you go to forests in Africa, you find that the smart primates didn't get cell phones, or in the forest they stuff themselves on something and then they lie around for 2 days, you know, bonobos, and you know, who's really smart here? Anyway, so primates spend a lot of time in their history sort of lying around and recuperating and picking, getting extra protein by finding bugs and insects on each other and things like that. And so in a sense, we're in a weird state. All of humanity is in this bizarre state where we're subjecting our cognitive processes to things guys, I can't talk if you're talking. Thanks. See what I mean? Anyway, we're subjecting ourselves to something that hasn't happened to our species ever before, which is pushing our limit, our brain's capacity to the limit and beyond. And there's, you know, one would think, oh, that's a great thing, you know, expand your consciousness and be able to do more email, you know, and more instant messaging and more texting. But there's a huge social societal price we're going to pay for this. And I think most, you know, with due respect to most academics, people who research, they're about 5 to 10 years behind current trends. So by the time we start to study this stuff, it'll be endemic throughout society. Back at the farm, and if you're ever in Northern California, please come and visit us. I have a barn, we have a barn, and it's full of 600 vintage computers. And they all work. And they're from 1973, and it documents the history of the beginnings of personal computing and digital community networks, whatever, everything crazy, supercomputers and Altairs and Altos and all of it. You know, from the various garages in Silicon Valley. And it's to document the invention and the culture that came out from the personal computer and then the network. And, you know, in a sense, you can go and look back then and you can say, oh, it's 1979, and the only people in the world were sitting in front of a computer with a graphical display and doing email were people at Xerox PARC and a few other places. And they were living in that future. And you go back and talk to them, and they kind of invented that lifestyle. And they never thought that a billion people would be doing that. Maybe 2 billion people on cell phones doing that in a similar interface that they invented. They couldn't have conceived of it. So what all of this is coming to is a sort of a giant unplanned experiment that you're all part of. And what I'd like to do is to sort of show you two snippets of work that we do at the company. The first one, I'll just explain this before you start it. No, let it go. This is astronaut training visualization for Johnson Space Center. So, I'll let these guys talk a little bit. What they're doing is they're training for one of the most dangerous and important missions in NASA's history coming up in the spring, to replace a giant 600-pound gyro part that has gone bad on the station. If they can't replace it, the station could end up with no ability to control its attitude to move itself around. And so these guys have been training for a couple of years, or year and a half, in the swimming pool in Houston called the Neutral Buoyancy Lab. And these guys, there's one guy whose feet are on this robot arm, and he's just bringing down the broken gyro to the guy who's now going to attach it to something on the shuttle cargo bay. Then they have to go over and unscrew the replacement gyro and stick it on the station, cable it up, spin it up, and see if it works. They don't know what caused the broken gyro to grind to a halt. It was grinding and vibrating for 24 hours before it failed. And so basically, these guys are in a highly challenged cognitive environment. They have 6 or 7 voice channels into their suit. They have 6 degrees of freedom. They're moving. They have so many things can go wrong. The sun's rising and setting, and they're doing this procedure for 11 hours. It's like 11-hour brain surgery. And what happens on spacewalks like this is, and we do a 3D reconstruction from the swimming pool training in order so that they can sit in front of a computer and see it from another perspective and put themselves on the, make themselves into the gyro. What is the gyro seeing as I'm moving it? When does the sun rise and set? Because when the sun rises, it blinds you. So if you're in the middle of undoing a fastener or something, you can't see something. These guys tend to get cognitively overloaded, and they get brain fuzzy after about 3 hours if they're intensely communicating or whatever. Maybe if they're 13 years old, they could do the whole procedure straight through, but these guys are in their 40s and 50s, and so their thresholds are getting lower and lower and lower. Give you an example, the Mir space station, which was almost lost when a Progress supply ship was coming up. You remember this? And it slammed into the station, it bounced off a module, and the module was seal was breached and started to depressurize. Well, the commander said, I looked up at the monitor and there it was, and then I looked back and it was gone. It wasn't there, because he was seeing it come in. It was an automatic docking of this. And what he was in a total cognitive overload. He was in total fatigue. And he blacked out. His brain just, he went into a stasis for about 10 seconds, a critical 10 seconds. He was overloaded, brain stopped working. Blacked out, unconscious of it, but still sitting there, came back, and then the ship was, they were in the middle of an emergency. So that's exactly where human beings can go. If our technology around us and our social demands, that's the condition that you can put somebody in. So it's absolutely not his fault. I mean, of course, it's like, Valentin, why did you do this? And like, I don't know how to answer that. Because they had driven him so hard that he stopped functioning. He broke as a part. And every one of you in your offices, at work, or whatever, you're kind of getting up to that threshold now and then, and maybe going into that threshold. And one of the things I was so fascinated by this, because we work in the area of trying to help people deal with this, was what causes that cognitive overload, and what in a very simple model of the brain, and then we're reading an article by Damasio, some of his new work, who many of you know is a brain researcher. And he wrote this article. It was like a total revelation to me. It's kind of like Alan's talk yesterday morning was a big revelation to me on where did my creativity go. Well, I'm writing federal contracts. That's why it's not. That little valve is completely stuck open, and nothing's going through the creativity side anymore. But except these talks, perhaps. Damasio seems to be showing, and this is something. We have friends in a clinical acupuncture practice in New York City, and they kept telling us, and his name is Mark and Warner Seam, and Mark wrote, probably was responsible more than anybody else bringing Chinese acupuncture to the U.S. and writing about it and westernizing it. And he said, our practice, we're starting to get all these people whose adrenal systems are shot, who come in, and the only thing that they can get is a nervous system reboot. So we give them, you know, pretty deep acupuncture, try to restart them. And a lot of them, as it turns out, a lot of Orthodox Jews, including rabbis and whatnot, who are so wired and stressed out that they've all gone in to go to acupuncture. And I started reading up about this, and it turns out that there's this whole booming field of clinical diagnosis of something called adrenal exhaustion, where people are tripped out on interrupts. And so, for instance, they come in the morning, and you know what I'm talking about, and they start getting email, and they go, "Great, I'm feeling great. That's emails coming in. I exist, therefore I get email, therefore I exist, etc., etc." And there's stimulus response, Pavlov's dog, right? This, the, "I exist, I exist." And what is happening is their eyes are darting around on the screen, and they're sitting totally still, and their eyes are darting around. Now they're doing rapid eye movement, and those darting of the eyes are driving your adrenal system to pump out a little bit of adrenaline. Because if you're a primate in the wild and there's a cheetah stalking, you're doing like this, and that is driving your adrenal system to get ready to run, if something is out there. Now, if you're sitting in an office doing this, you're getting a wonderful high, but your body's not moving. It's all piling up in your body. And you hit a crash, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you dump. So where do you go? You go to Starbucks, you know, or somebody brings you coffee to pump it up again. And this continual cycle, then you're in traffic on the way home and nothing seems real. You know, it's like nothing seems real. And you don't know what's happening to you. And you go home and you have a fight with your spouse, but you don't even remember the fight because nothing seems real. What's happening? Well, you're not really feeling much. Now, Damasio is powering all his research onto this area. And there, what he's finding is what he's claiming is that there's sort of a two-speed brain. One part of your brain is the millisecond responsive cognitive part of the brain. Just bang, bang, hey, I got that email back, go fast, and I can handle all this stuff, I can text like this, and you know, and your brain is has a hunger for this stuff, this cognitive rapid response stuff, and if you're proud, and it can just do things so quickly. And then there's another part of the brain that does the emotional processing. And it turns out that the access to either store an emotional sense or retrieve it and use it is very slow. It's like seconds or even minutes. The cognitive part is like bam, bam. Now we're probably evolved to be that way. You know, we're sitting around in our primate community and somebody hits somebody else and everyone goes, oh, you know, then they have to digest that. But if suddenly a troop of monkeys appears and a scout appears and they're going to steal all the food and start hammering you, and they each have to do something, boom, they're reacting. Like, quickly, you go over there, you do, you know, so that the two functions that we had to supply to survive. So what Damasio is showing is that people who, in the lab, who get a huge amount of cognitive stimulus all the time, start to have no access to the emotional part at all. They can't store to it and they can't retreat from it. They become what he calls emotionally neutral. That's a very innocuous term, but it's a very scary scary result. Because if you become emotionally neutral and you're driving home in your big SUV and you run over somebody, you'll just keep driving. If you're head of a company, right, and it's like you're frazzled and you have no connection to your emotions, and it's like, we need to lay off 10,000 people, you just all do it. You know, like, that has my cognitive need to get a better result for the analysts who are hammering me, and I'm just a numbers guy anyway. Let those 10,000 people go. No emotional connections. If you're a president of a country and it's like, let's saturation bomb this area. Yeah, let's do it. We see it on the screen and we see that, yeah, see that blob of blue stuff? Well, that'll all be red stuff and we'll be okay. No emotional connection. Big danger for humanity here. Now, of course, there's another interesting on the spectrum, and Galen will run this next piece, just sort of diverging back to the other part of our work. What if you're a little kid, and what if you have autism, Let's actually show you this game. And what if you don't even understand what a street is, or what a street crossing is? What if a room like this full of people like you would put you into immediate overload where you freeze? What if a house that you're sitting in is on fire and it starts to burn down and you freeze because the flames and smoke are too much information? A child with autism often reaches this cognitive overload threshold like that, just bang. But what was discovered by Dorothy Strickland a few years back, and several other people, we've worked with her, Gail's worked with her for years, is that these kids in a computer game like this, they'll fixate. This is a perfect world for them. They'll look at this dog buddy's face, they'll follow the instructions, they'll listen to the voice and the songs, and they'll move around in a world, and they're profoundly autistic, and they'll use the cursor keys, and they'll learn things. And because an autistic child is not necessarily low IQ, they'll also try to break the game and trick the game. But here we have buddies saying, come on, let's follow me, I'm going to show you how to cross the street. And Gail's not playing this, but behind it, this is a soundtrack of continual stimulating sound that many of you heard when you came in. And yeah, push the, see if we can get that. Okay, there we go. Push the pause. There we go. And then when you close that window, and click again on the window. So. So Buddy's waiting for you to look left and right and left again, and then you can cross the street. So, yes. So you get the idea. And these children sit down in front of these games, and they build a mental model of the world that you're gonna have to push the mute button. And they build a mental model of the world, because for them, being in front of a computer screen isn't necessarily a big cognitive stimulation that they're going to do 1,000 instant messages. For them, it's a way to understand the world. So, as with any powerful tool, this digital technology and immersive virtual worlds, which are like drug trips, let's face it, and they do immerse people, I call it a double-edged broadsword. It's so powerful it can cut your head off, or you could use it to go across a creek practically. This environment is so powerful. Because unlike just instant messaging and telephones, you're totally visually enveloped in these environments. Even if it's just on a small computer screen. So she's looking left, right, and left to, and she, good job. And now she can cross. And they're gonna cross. So if she tries to go outside the lines, it'll throw her right back onto the sidewalk in kind of a nice way. Never run into the road. Now you still have to look left, right, and left. So these kids will go through this game hundreds of times. They'll initially try to break it, and then they'll try to do it. They'll actually try to make it, and then they get rewards at the end. There's the reward. So whether it's an astronaut who's trying to keep from making such an incredible mistake on orbit that, like slamming a control moment gyro against the U.S. lab, which would be not only a big embarrassment and a career terminator for them, but it would cause other things. People be killed and things like that. But they're also trying to, we're trying to help these autistic kids get overwhelmed with data to build models and actually function in the first place in the world. And I think it would be interesting to show you. You have to turn the sound back up a bit. One of the things that people keep mentioning here is they keep mentioning Burning Man. And truthfully, Larry Harvey talks about regional burns and models for changing all of humanity. But to my mind, Burning Man is like 80% about people trying to come to a place where they reconnect with the emotional part of themselves, the creative part of themselves, because they're so suffering. And they're so desiccated in the outside world and their job from that. And they need to come to a place that maybe isn't acupuncture that does a nervous system reboot, but they need a place to get sane again, or try to find their way back to where they thought they were when they were humans. and that's really what Burning Man is about, and maybe Burning Man, and if they can take some of that back, some of that rebalancing back into their lives, they can affect the world. But unfortunately, I think Burning Man is a symptom of the disease. It's not necessarily a, you know, if the whole planet was Burning Man, of course, we need, you know, thousands of more Walmarts to supply these people because there's no ability. If Burning Man was 500,000 people and actually was in the entire Black Rock Desert, it would be one of the most egregiously consuming entities and leave the mountains of trash you can't imagine because it's just an unsustainable community. But it's a tremendous place to try to walk back to becoming a human being again. And this year we found that there was very little art on the fly, and I think that's possibly due to the funding regime now that exists for art projects, which being in the federal procurement system, what you're starting to see is people competing for dollars to get their art out there. And then, you know, to build a big piece, you get more, or, you know, how do they measure it? And it's not that they're burning up their own capital, their own cells, they're actually getting funded to do things. Of course, things are good that they're doing, but there's conspicuous absence, like 90% absence of art, large pieces. Strange. And the man was very underwhelming in terms of its structure. It was a good theme, but the temple, David Best's temple, you saw a couple pictures of yesterday, was tremendous. It was possibly the best one yet, I think. And maybe if Galen can run the movie sort of from... Yeah, start with the one with the people walking along the... No, start with yours. Okay. So this is from upstairs in the temple, looking at the... You could actually climb up into the second story of the temple, and these people are looking down on people who are writing the names of loved ones who have passed away. Very moving place. In the next one, I just keep going along. This is sort of looking down, and this is a man who's writing a long piece of memorial text, probably on a piece of the temple that you could pick up, and then putting it in. And there's photographs. And the next one. This is kind of just looking at people coming up into the upper part of the temple, and there's just beauty of the construction of it. And this is just another view of leaving. That's when we were departing and going down. And of course, the whole structure is burned. It was burned 4 hours after we took this video. And unlike the burning of the man, the burning of the man kind of is like anybody's guess as to what it means. And the temple is very clear what it means, is you put something there that you wanted to memorialize somebody or something, and you had a personal relationship with it. And so the burning of the temple is for us the highlight of Burning Man these days. And I think Galen can show you, we're lucky enough, and there were a couple people in this room were right next to us because they heard this song. I just captured this on video. Maybe we'll play it and just give you an idea what this was like. This is Galen singing. Amazing grace, how sweet. She's singing that in Haida, which is a West Coast Indian language, Native American language. Sounds good to have a piper, isn't it? Burning Man is us trying, sort of well-off nerds from the Western Hemisphere or Western world, trying to reconnect with something that's very old. And Terence talked about sort of new, what did he call it, new primitive or new tribal. And that's kind of a theme as he has like grown from that. But in a sense, as humanity is really being stretched here, and it's almost as if a certain proportion of humanity becomes fully emotionally neutral. It's like every vision of every science fiction cyberpunk come true, because you've got, you know, there would be Neuromancer jacked into the metaverse, or, you know, Orwell's 1984, and people just sort of drones. And there's no emotional life. And that can be achieved through this giant cognitive driving factor. And you can probably sense it in your cells, and I think it not only, if you don't have access to the emotional part, the emotional mechanism, you can't be creative. I really believe that. One of the things that Damasio gives as an example of this is, he says, if you are in a state of emotional neutrality, and you call someone on the phone, and you're going to ask them for a favor, and they start to say, you know, I'm having a terrible day, blah, 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 and this is what's happened to me, and whatever. A person who's kind of present, what they do, what he claims people do, is they do simulations. You become that person just for an instant. You simulate them in your own body, in your own emotional state of mind. And then you have what's called an intuitive flash about whether you should ask them for that favor now or not. So if you don't have the door is open and you can't simulate, i.e. you have no empathy for other people, you can't simulate, you have no intuition. And you have no intuition with social intuition. And you're joining the continuum of autism in some sense, because everything is going to be about data and driving your goals and whatever. You're kind of a cognitive autist. At that point, and you'll just talk right over top of people. You don't hear what people are saying. And, you know, talk about being difficult to raise a family, being difficult just to function. And in a sense, people who are also over-mediated, who are not only in this cognitively overstimulated state where they're losing emotional connection, but they're watching so much TV. And the TV and the reality TV is becoming their lives. They're using reality-based TV to create temporary simulations in themselves so that they feel something. Like, is she going to get the guy? Or, you know, is they going to get, you know, it's like, yeah, is Trump going to hire them? And they feel all wrapped up in it, but it's being substituted for their own ability to do that. Because we're story machines, and if we have a story being told, we're willing to throw away our complete person and adopt that story. But when the story's over and the TV's off after 6 or 8 hours a day or whatever, you're left pretty empty from that experience. So it's what's interesting is, you know, this conference is about mind states, but I think what you could do is look at the mind states out there that everybody's in. They're in an altered mind state. You know, what is a non-altered mind state? But I think that you could say that a hunking big proportion of society is in an altered mindset that's actually could be clinically diagnosable. And they're popping Xanax or whatever, they're popping Prozac. I mean, they're medicating themselves, they're mediating themselves, and trying to keep their sense that, am I still here, kind of thing. So everybody's in a mind state that may be, and in a sense, we talk about saving the planet and whatnot, you can't even start to think about it until you solve this problem. Now, of course, the thing that can alter the mind state is, well, maybe even not. If there's an incoming asteroid, people would not really connect with that emotionally. Like, okay, you know, don't see it now. You know, maybe it's just a TV show. You know, would that wake people up? Would housing price crash and half the country be out on the street and foreclosures and bank failures? And would that wake people up? It might. Would it be global climate change? I mean, just physical discomfort for primates would probably wake them up. What you tend to find, and this is also in Damasio's work, is that a person has become emotionally neutral and they're just motoring along on their cognitive stimulation. When they have an accident or something, when a loved one dies, they have no buffer. It tends to either, they don't know, they have no connection with it, and the family members can't understand, or they plunge headlong into a complete breakdown. Because now they're overwhelmed with something in front of them that is undeniable. Now they've lost their cognitive state just goes bluey, and they're now in a sense in an unprepared emotional state. They've not been using that mechanism for a long time. Suddenly they're sunk into it, and they will crash. And that's not good either. And so I think, I mean, is this a very positive view of the thing? But it's all part of the giant unplanned experiment. And I think, I'm just trying to think of what I was going to conclude with. I was supposed to say something positive. Anyway, psychedelics. Yeah, there we go. So when you can go to Burning Man, you can go get acupuncture from the beams, you can, from the seams, you can do a lot of things. And in psychedelic state, perhaps what you're doing is you're simply, because you're putting your entire self aside and allowing yourself to be filled with something else. And it may be the use of psychedelics may be the most powerful antidote to this growing critical problem for primates, the primate brain. So perhaps, you know, if there is some kind of, you know, where does society go from here? What if 3/4 of the American population is emotionally neutral and they're driving, and there's a breakdown? Well, maybe one of the solutions is the kinds of things that, say, the Shulgins are evolving, the Pioneer, or you guys are evolving. Maybe that's the only way back from this abyss. So another kind of perspective on the overall mind states of the entire planet right now. That's why it's nice to come to Mexico, because fewer people are in this state. So why don't we open it up to questions, comments, criticisms?
Where are you located in Northern California?
We are in the Santa Cruz Mountains, west of San Jose and south of San Francisco.
What's the name of the Damasio book
referring to?
Which one?
Well, is it one particular book? It's the Damasio book, Feeling of What Happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Question in the back. The Feeling of What Happens.
I guess my comment is that as a psychedelic user and as someone who is involved in certain communities that are smaller, I find it more difficult still to relate. And even more difficult because I've used psychedelics or because I've joined up with these communities, more difficult to relate to that 3/4 of the percent of the population that's still within this mind state of disassociation. And I'm wondering how Burning Man or something like the tribal or something like mind states, I mean, I think that's why I'm here, and I'm wondering how other people can relate to this. Is how is this essentially helping us? Because what it's doing is it's creating these small semi-urban or quasi-urban tribes, which allow us to kind of express ourselves under these small micro kind of environments. Really still hyper disassociate ourselves from you know, the rest of society, and although that may be healthy, I don't necessarily be integrated into the reality that you need. At least for myself, and I can't speak for everybody else here, is that, you know, I was hoping that psychedelics would help me integrate better into a larger sense of society, that I could communicate with more people instead of fewer people, and as much as I'd like to embrace my freedom, I think that part of embracing that is also to disassociate yourself with a greater sense, you know, and I feel like that's the great danger here. That's the great danger of things like Brain Man or Moon Tribe or Mind States, and as much as I love all of it and love all of you, you know, it presents a danger for us if we can become really inclusive and insular, excuse me, and then kind of think everything's all right, but you still never wake up in the morning. Most of us do still have to wake up in the morning to go to work and figure out, how am I going to relate to that guy who wants to talk to me about the last episode of Friends? You know, when I just had this like seriously dope experience in the middle of the desert, how am I going to really do that? And I'm interested here, instead of necessarily talking, and don't get me wrong, Lean In is a great thing, you've got a great thing, my fix is a great thing. How are we trying to communicate with the rest of the people? You know, I we can no longer maintain this kind of, like you said, unsustainable or insustainable of psychedelics and just a small way.
My sense about this whole thing is that there's going to be some huge crisis in the next decades, and a lot of people are going to be dumped into a very confused, and you know, the old models will be discredited, and people will be really hurting. And I think that if you guys can build yourselves up, and the loving energy that you have, and the insights that you have, and get ready to help some people, because we're all going to hit the wall, but the people who are caught, who are in the state of wired into all that media and all that cognitive dissonance, are gonna, the plunge for them is gonna be very far. And I think it's just, it may not happen in our lifetimes, but it might. Is that? Yeah. Whose hand shot up first? I think Chris did.
I'm concerned about competition among primates. Project yourself back, let's say, 10 years ago, and let's say you were going to enter the same field you did, but with current technology today. Do you think you could compete and be successful without having to immerse yourself in all the email and interactive structure?
Yeah, you know what I have. This morning, I'll have to tell you some guys something personally. I'm a principal investigator on a giant proposal for NASA, and I wrote an email to these people. And I said to our prime, well, it's Raytheon and people like that, and I said, guys, the reporting requirements are so brutal for this thing. You know, monthly, I mean, full cost accounting monthly reports. Okay, the whole thing, and we have two universities and two giant companies and three NASA centers that I've, in my exuberance, signed up for this proposal. And I said, this is going to kill me. And can somebody else lead this thing? We would be very happy to be a little supportive role, but even if I can find the best contract manager, and if any of you can do this, anybody know what GNA means? Raise their hand, please. But the truth of the matter is I'm probably going to back out, and I'm going to say, I will sub to anybody, but I don't want the responsibility. It will kill me. And all you guys will get paid your salaries, and I'll be a piece of jello at the end of this thing. And I won't have painted a picture, or, you know, Gail won't be able to reach me at all, because I'll be doing back-to-back reports every day. And yes, we may go back to the moon, but I'll be probably dead from the process. So anyway, that's a decision you have to make, actually, is how much you take on.
Actually, we want to respond to his concerns.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, Ken Sonnington once called me, every shaman he knows has a day job. You've got to keep one foot in each world. You heard my presentation, I was in 27, he was shorting water and grounding and seeing problems in business, pretty much. You have to make a daily grit sometimes. And you come to these things to recharge your batteries and to like boost it. Like a booster dose, you know, to get strong. And then you go back. And then just, yeah, you're in that world, you're in that world, you're every corner of it. But hopefully, at some point, becoming a virus. And we begin to
share a frequency.
Yeah.
Go
undercover, be an undercover freak. I did for a long time. But then it's kind of like the only other species.
I have to give a question to my cat goddess here.
But just that I wanted to submit to you also, because it's a wonderful question. One more example from Burning Man. The first year of the temple was particularly extraordinary. It was several years ago, and there was this immense structure that was unusually beautiful and made out of little pieces of wood, and it looked like a Jain temple, and it looked like a Christian cathedral. It looked like East meets West in every spiritual edifice you'd ever seen. And all that day, the wind blew. And it was as far out as you could get. So it would disappear and then appear and then disappear and then reappear. It was as stunning a symbol of the ephemeral as you could imagine. And at dusk, we all gathered around it, not knowing what was going to happen. And just as the torchbearers prepared to set it on fire, the wind began to blow again. And it blew for 2 hours and coated all of us in this thick gray dust. So we looked like this race of elders bearing witness with red eyes. And just at the moment when we could hardly bear it a second longer, the wind stopped, the torchbearers went in, and it went up in flames. And just as it was at the height of burning, I felt a kind of hand come down and rip me open, and I felt a grief that was not personal grief. It was a kind of grief for I didn't even know what, the world, the cosmos. And I started to scream and cry, and I realized other people around me were doing that. And I looked up, and there was the full moon. And I wondered, what is it that we as a species need to learn about collective, shared, witnessed grieving? That we need to learn on this planet so badly right now that even the wind and the moon are bearing witness to this. And they want to give us an image of a burning building that looks like East and West that will drive us to our knees in grief so that we can begin as a planet to heal one another. Well, that was September 4th, 2001, and you know the image that got burned into this planet just a week later. We've all seen it, and you know that there was no chance as a planet, certainly not as an American nation, to grieve. You know what happened. We were induced as much as we could be induced by some crazy power to go into a state of fear and dread and rage. And mutual suspicion, just the kind of thing that you're talking about that separates us. And what I would submit is that what we need to do is take images from gatherings like this and from Burning Man, from all the places
like
that
the
go, take those images, the Gray's images. That work is so incredibly beautiful. And to carry those images inside of us and be so transmissive of those images that we're spreading them. Consciously, unconsciously, superconscious, metaconsciously, because I think that the crash has already happened and that the healing is already beginning and that we're a very deep part of it. That's why we come together. It's why we go to Burning Man and come here, is to give one another images that we then go out and share with everyone we meet by being as much a state of love and grace and transmission as we possibly can.
Okay, thank you.
So that's my suggestion.
Because we have to wrap this up, I might suggest that at lunch or that if there's a group of you who want to keep talking about this, let's form a group and keep talking, because this is a real important one.
Yeah, this is a big one.
And with that, I yield to Mr. Hatt.